Wow, it is the end of 2019, you guys. The end of the year.
Yeah.
And you know what we like to do? We like to ask our wonderful Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners for their help. We need you to support your local station so that you can support us. And you know, as I started to put this together, I realized something, which is 2019, big year. Big year.
Hot take.
I'm not kidding. You know, I want to read you just a few of the things that we did in 2019 on this show that we talked about, that we helped our listeners, we hope, know a little more about. Super Bowl, Oscars, Tonys, Grammys, Emmys, Golden Globes, VMAs. That's just the events. Then you also have Marie Kondo, Masked Singer, If Beale Street Could Talk, Parasite, Dolomite Is My Name, Russian Doll, Captain Marvel, Pen 15. Remember all that stuff about Theranos that we did?
Sure.
Remember the Metropolitan Opera, Booksmart. Are you guys happy yet? Do you remember what a great year it was? And you know what makes it possible for us to do this? You know who makes it possible for us to do this?
Who does that, Linda?
It's our listeners. It's the listeners. They give to their local station, and you can too, at donate.npr.org/happy. That's donate.npr.org/happy. That way, we get to be supported, and we get to beat all the other podcasts at NPR, and you know how much we love that. So go to donate.npr.org/happy. Greta Gerwig was nominated for an Oscar for directing 2017's Lady Bird. She's following it up with an adaptation of Little Women that features two of her Lady Bird stars, Saoirse Ronan and Timothée Chalamet.
Ronan plays Jo, the free-spirited March sister. Chalamet plays their neighbor, Laurie. They're joined by Emma Watson, Florence Pugh, and Eliza Scanlon, along with Laura Dern and Meryl Streep. Gerwig also wrote the script, which makes some changes both to the story and the structure of Louisa May Alcott's book. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Little Women on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, who could it be other than Weekend Edition Books editor Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
I'm so happy to be with all of you. If you're not familiar with Little Women, and I will say, I don't think there are Little Women spoilers at this point. Mm-hmm. I think it is such an old book, which was originally, by the way, two books,
a
book and a sequel, that came out in the late 1860s. It follows this family made up of these four girls and their mother who are home while father is off fighting in the Civil War. And then the sisters have various relationships and happenings and things occur. Stephen, what'd you think?
The women are regular sized. 0 stars.
Right.
Barry, what did you think? if I were an eccentric billionaire, I would just keep Greta Gerwig, Saoirse Ronan, and Timothée Chalamet on retainer. Mm. And then every year I would call them all into my mansion and I would explain to them that they are to make a movie in which Saoirse Ronan is steely and flinty and individual and determined, and Timothée Chalamet is a huge disappointment. And I would just say, go make me another movie just like that. Uh-huh. I am so in. I loved this movie from start to finish. My face just sort of leaked quietly throughout the film. I just loved swimming around with these characters. I am not necessarily a big Little Women person. I didn't spend a ton of time with the book. I've seen an adaptation here and there. I knew the basic contours of the story, but it is not etched into each individual strand of my DNA the way it is, I think, for a lot of the people who are going to flip their wig for this movie.
Yeah.
I just loved it, though. I think, first of all, I have loved Saoirse Ronan in basically everything she's been in. She is perfectly cast here. I think almost every single individual piece of casting is great. There is one piece of casting late in the film that jumped out at me. Seeing Bob Odenkirk as their dad didn't.
But if you didn't know he was Bob Odenkirk, I think he was fine.
He's fine. Oh, God. I love Bob Odenkirk.
I think it's resonating with your that's someone else.
You see him in Mutton Chops and you just go to a Mr. Show place.
I really do. Yeah. But otherwise, Florence Pugh, who was having herself a year, she is also in Midsummer. She is Amy and just brings so many additional dimensions to that character.
Because Amy is the youngest and she's often the kind of selfish, unlikable one, particularly when they're young.
And she gets such an arc in this movie, and her expressions alone. I just really like, it's one of those movies where by the end, I felt myself having an emotional reaction to knowing that it was about to end and that I wasn't going to get to hang out with those characters anymore, which is a reaction I have to just movies where they have done such a beautiful job fleshing out the characters.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Barry,
you're
squeaking with happiness.
No, I actually, I love Steven's reaction so much. Like, in some ways, his reaction epitomizes the thing that's so great about this movie, because I do have Little Women etched into different places in my DNA. And I think the thing that's so great about this movie is it's a great movie separate from that. And Steven's reaction really, I think, it also makes me fall in love with Steven all over again. Anyway, while I do love Little Women, it is a book that... And I actually love all the previous adaptations for different reasons. Mm-hmm. This adaptation is head and shoulders above every single one, because it's also a great movie about something else. Mm-hmm. It is also just about the writing process.
Yeah, because Joe is a writer,
and that is captured in the book a little more. And no movie has yet really plumbed that the way that this has, in a way that I thought was just brilliant. What Greta Gerwig has done here is she's taken all the strands of all the stories. And everybody, I mean, even if you haven't read the book, as Stephen was saying, you do sort of know these strands. Like, Amy's terrible. Lori's like, maybe he's hot. I don't know. All of those strands exist. And she has reordered them in a very brave way. I actually got there just during the credits. And I thought when I sat down, oh, I missed too much, because they have reordered it to the point that it's actually maybe a little shocking if you haven't read the book, if you have read the book. But what it does is it allows each character's true nature to come through in a way that is so much more true, I think, to the characters that Louisa May Alcott intended.
Right.
I will tell you, Amy burning the book is something that has, like, lived in my soul. And every now and then, you know, I'll just be out, like, out and about and think, ugh, Amy. You know, like, why did she save her? Like, why did she go back in the river? This is the first adaptation or time I've seen this story told where I thought, you know what, I might have actually picked her out of the pond. This is the first time I saw who Amy was. Yeah. And a lot of that isn't just about the amazing acting, and I am such a huge Florence Pugh fan, but it is also just about purely this structural change that is a fascinating thing to look over the top of, to be inside of. I watched it and I thought, oh my God, my husband's going to love this movie. My 8-year-old child is going to love this movie. This is a great movie.
Yeah. And I wanted just to sort of situate people a little bit in what she does structurally. Right. As we said, the book was originally two books, which is why it's made up of essentially two time periods. It's kind of a chunk of book that takes place when they're a little younger, and then a chunk of book that takes place when they're a little older. And typically when you have an adaptation, it'll go, and there are many, including the, for a lot of people I suspect who listen to this, will be the Winona Ryder one, where she was Jo and Susan Sarandon was Marmee, and et cetera. And usually they'll just go in chronological order. You go through the young section and then you go through the old section. What Gerwig has done here is reorganize it so that you start essentially in the older section and then she begins to look back on that earlier section. Glenn, what did you think of how this went?
Well, I'd never read the book, never saw any adaptations. So I went into this knowing only two things. Well, three. One, it's not about large men. Got that from the title. And two, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, the first line of the novel. I learned a lot of first lines of novels at some point for some reason. And three, that at some point somebody burns somebody's novel, which is the act of a monster.
Yeah.
But it also told me that somebody in the book is a writer, and that kind of tensed me up a little bit.
Because
writing about the writing process, stories about writers tend toward preciousness, tend toward treating writing as more some kind of hallowed magical craft or something. And that had me worried. There is no preciousness in this film. I mean, there's some, but there's not what I was expecting. Not having read the book, I can tell this is a smart adaptation. Why? Because the dialogue sounds so natural. This dialogue, much of it lifted straight from the book, is 151 years old, which is not far enough away to sound like poetry, Shakespeare, and it's not close enough to sound contemporary. It's going to sound formal. It's going to be stilted, which puts a hell of a lot of pressure on your actors to make it sound real. We're used to some stiffness in dialogue from period dramas, but there is none here. You can sometimes tell when something comes straight from the novel, but I'm going to join the Florence Pugh fan club here because she is, I think, the best at it on screen.
Agreed.
She brings this kind of clear-eyed intelligence that makes what she's saying sound considered, but not scripted, if that makes sense. You get a real sense that these are sisters. There's something about that flurry of activity in the house, the kind of musical almost noise that constantly goes on. The time jumps didn't bother me because, you know, you're washed in a different kind of light, so you kind of orient yourself very well. I dug it. Dug the hell out of it.
I want to talk a little bit about, I'm so glad you mentioned that kind of raucous nature of the activity in the house. It is very easy for a Little Women adaptation to become very... very like, oh, mother, like get like they're fun and they're having fun, but they're having a very angelic, polite kind of fun. Like, oh, I terribly want some breakfast. Like that. It's very easy for it to get that feel to it. It is a house full of raucous girls running around having fun together. They're not as attached to flattening out kind of Meg as the older responsible one.
Yes.
And Beth as the angelic, saintly, doomed one. And or Amy as the jerk.
Right.
They are much more able to kind of, these girls all have different shadings, but they all have a great time together and they all love each other and they all play together. And not in that sort of, as I said, very polite kind of way. If you compare, I happen to go back and look at the scene in the 1994 adaptation with Winona Ryder, in which Claire Danes plays Beth as a very, and I adore Claire Danes, but it is the very pure-hearted, saintly version of Beth. If you go back and watch the scene where the girls are all kind of doing theater together, they've got a little club and they go up in the attic or wherever it is and put on little shows. It is, in this adaptation, such a fun, loud, sort of stomping, kind of just really adventurous. They're having a great, giggly time. It's much more controlled energy in this 1994 adaptation. So what I really love in the Greta Gerwig one is they've really kind of let all of these girls be fun and interesting. They don't focus on the idea that Beth has to be some untouchable, perfect saint in order for them to all have the emotions that they need to have about her illness.
It's so funny that you say it, because I actually, this movie was sort of advertised, not advertised, somebody said to me, oh, I've heard they're going to rehabilitate Amy in this. And to a certain extent, what they do is they show you Amy in the right order so you can understand something about her. But what they really do kind of is rehabilitate Beth, not to the point of living. Her first sort of entrance is she's expressing, you know, I kind of wish I could eat this breakfast and not give it away. You know, her shyness with Laurie's grandfather, it feels more like the kind of shyness that doesn't come with, like, and beatitude, but more with a real pathology. Like, she feels real. And so as a result, you know, it's the first time that now I sound like a monster, but it's the first time I was really sad see Beth go.
Well, it may, you know? A human being, you're always sadder to see something bad happen to a fully rounded person, I think. At least that is our sensibility. I also want to talk a little bit about the love stories in this, particularly the Joe and Laurie, kind of the classic problem with Little Women to me, and then I'll ask you guys what you think about how they solved this. The classic problem to me with Little Women is, and it's partly because it was two books,
right,
that you spend a lot of time building this relationship between Laurie and Joe. And then she decides she doesn't want to marry Laurie to Joe. So you get a kind of a, it's all build up and then kind of it punks out. And then in some versions of this, you get an older guy that Joe meets who is sort of a drip. And they've made some changes to it here.
Yeah, they have.
Yeah.
And they are welcome.
Yeah, and that I don't want to spoil. I mean, obviously, some of this stuff we're talking about, 150-year-old spoilers. But this movie makes some decisions to upend some things and to subvert some things in really smart and contemporary ways where you feel the hand of Greta Gerwig exactly the way you would hope to.
It feels like the kind of thing that Louisa May Alcott, like it feels like the hand of Greta Gerwig's firmly in the hand of Louisa May Alcott. I think that maybe that was what she was trying to show us with the Fred Bear character. And I mean, this is the thing I always think of with these adaptations. There are some things that, you know, that react so well because you can stretch the fabric and not break it. And this is a perfect example of that, where she stretches it, but she doesn't actually rend the fabric of the story. And as a result, I feel like it feels true to the author.
I do like the fact that Laurie is allowed here to be kind of explored as, they meet him kind of of when he's a kid.
And he's,
and he's kind of a
jerk.
He's kind of undeveloped. He's unformed because he's a kid.
Timothy Chalamet.
He's perfect at being that.
And I think you get that sort of, she's set it up so that everything that happens with him kind of makes sense and has a wholeness to it.
Yeah, they give him an arc. I think this movie is so beautifully cast that we have been talking about it for as long as we've been talking about it and not mentioned the name Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
They deploy
Aunt March.
Meryl Streep is Aunt March, and you think, like, okay, she's coming in and she's going to be like, ooh, and she does, but it's dialed down to the point where it really complements everything else that's going on in the movie. Instead of, like, you've got Meryl Streep in your arsenal, they're not over-deploying her. They're using her, I think, the exact correct amount. And it is, sometimes Meryl Streep can take me out of a movie.
That's a good point.
Even though she is such a committed actor. This, I thought, was a really effective way to use her.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that Laura Dern playing Marmee was, for me, a slightly different take on Marmee. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to do with that raucous household of girls. Marmee has a little more joy to her in this version. She's a little less noble suffering than she sometimes can be. Mm-hmm. She can be sort of, you know, always around the fireplace fretting over, oh, my girls, and all that stuff. Laura Dern has a real kind of, she enjoys these funny, weird girls that she's raising. And she's kind of the neighborhood mom who everybody wants to, who kind of Laurie's very attracted to the idea of the house she's running. And you can see how the warmth of it is so welcoming to him.
And you can see he's attracted to her, not just the, like, the raucousness of the house.
Right.
It's
but
her
that he
in
he
particular.
Likes her. Yeah. He likes and responds to her kind of mothering nature.
So we agree, like, 2.5 stars.
There is so much I
love
about this movie. I mean, I could do 20 minutes on just Saoirse Ronan and how wonderful I think she is to watch in this. How just, you know, she glows in the way that you want somebody to glow playing Jo March without being precious or, you know, she's so appealing. And I think Chalamet is so good in this. Everybody is so good in this.
Perfect deployment of Tracy Letts.
Yes, that's true.
And you'll see who he is playing when you see him. Just loved it. Absolutely loved it.
You can cut this if you want. Can I do a PSA for moms that are trying to finish the book with their daughters before they see this movie?
For sure.
This is going to be controversial, and I will be interested to see who agrees and does not agree with me. But a good friend of mine with a perfectly aged daughter is like, well, can't go see it this Christmas season because we're still working our way through the book. And I said to her, I said, guess what? I don't think it matters. This is one of the, like, few times that I say, go see this movie because it will really sort of water the interest in the book in a wonderful way. So if you are, say, the mother of a 9 or 10 year old girl or boy who you really feel attached to, let it go.
Yeah.
And go see this one.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you think once you've had a chance to see the movie. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller for authenticated luxury consignment. Consign men's and women's luxury fashion, fine jewelry, watches, art, and home. The Real Real offers free white glove service, in-store drop-off, or from-home shipping. Think sustainably. Consign with The Real Real today and earn up to 85% commission. This month, receive site credit when you consign 10 or more items. Authentic, sustainable luxury. Only at TheRealReal.com.
Support also comes from Zoom. What's a Zoom room? It's what your conference room is meant to be. With flawless video and audio conferencing, instant wireless content sharing from any device, and just one tap of a button to start a meeting, any space can easily become a modern, simple-to-use Zoom room. From tiny huddle rooms to executive offices to huge training rooms, and Zoom Rooms is effortlessly scalable, from a few rooms to a few thousand. Sign up online for a free 30-day trial of Zoom Rooms and meet happy with Zoom.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week, and let's face it, every week. What's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Doom Patrol on the DC Universe streaming service is a show that I have held off on because it is based on my single favorite run of comics in history, the Grant Morrison run on Doom Patrol. Under his pen, it became a very weird series about these misfit superheroes who have strange powers and battle these kind of existential threats. And it's just a kind of peyote weirdness at its core that is just fascinating and constantly unfolding. I just thought TV couldn't capture it. And they don't, but they go off on their own direction and make it weird. It doesn't always work. The characters bicker a hell of a lot, and that becomes kind of the entire show. But every so often, you know, there's an episode set on Danny the Street, who is a sentient, genderqueer street that kind of can transport from place to place around the globe. When I saw that happening, I wasn't aware it was going to happen. Then when I saw it happening, it's like, well, this is my favorite thing ever here on my television screen. So there's something about that. Also, Matt Bomer, who's going to complain.
Sure.
So that's Doom Patrol on DC Universe.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week, Ben?
A few weeks back, I got to interview Ben Folds at the Smithsonian, a wonderful singer-songwriter. He has a new book that came out this past summer called A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. And the book itself is this very funny, breezy, endlessly readable collection of stories, each of which are kind of interwoven with little lessons about mistakes that he's made along the way. It is such a fun book. Once again, it's called A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons by Ben Folds.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
Well, it is the most wonderful time of the year, so that's making me happy. And I did try to tailor my happy to the subject matter of Little Women because I figured there's a certain kind of person listening maybe who's
sure.
clicking on all the Little Women things. I had never seen the 2006 Ruth Wilson, Toby Stevens, Jane Eyre.
Oh.
And I am a person that, like Little Women, I've seen all of them. I've seen the Timothy Dalton, I've seen the Fassbenders, and I've seen all of them. This one is amazing. It's a great piece of television. And it does something very similar to the Little Women, you know, that we've been talking about, in that it has a very clever use of time and flashbacks in order to solve some of the real deep problems with the book.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of those real deep problems that it solves, this is the sexiest adaptation I've ever seen. Everyone is fully clothed the whole time, and it is incredible. This one is just a great piece of television. It's really perfect for this time of year because, you know, Thornfield Hall, it's cold, mm-hmm. it's warm, it's all the things. Go sit by the fire and enjoy it. And if you are one of those Mr. Rochester truthers that's like, well, he really wasn't that handsome, get over it, because just go watch Toby Stevens and enjoy
well, and
with your eggnog.
Where do we find it?
So many places, because I kept taking it to different places.
Oh,
you can
yes.
find it on your Hulu. You can find it on your on your Amazon. You can find it on your BritBox. You can
nice.
Find it in any of the places that you want to find it. Just find it.
I'm going to get Barry to say BritBox to me.
I want her to say Hulu.
All right. Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. What is making me happy this week? This is not the happy part, but I was sick one day this week, and I stayed home on my couch and just, like, tried to get well. And Netflix suggested to me the British drama series Dr. Foster. And Dr. Foster is, there are 2 5-episode seasons. The first one came out in 2015, the second in 2017. The lead character is played by a woman named Saran Jones, and she is a doctor. She is Dr. Foster. She is a woman who discovers what she thinks is evidence of her husband perhaps cheating on her. And she goes down this path of trying to figure out whether that's actually the case. If you like Killing Eve, you will see young Jodie Comer before Killing Eve. This central lead performance is one of these really fantastic and weighty anti-hero performances that are mostly men in prestige television. At the beginning, she just seems slightly odd, but then, of course, she becomes more and more kind of obsessed with this idea that her husband is cheating. I found it so addictive and so just so watchable that I watched 10 episodes of it in one day. And I just gobbled it up. It is a journey. It is wrenching at times. It is shocking at times. It is incredibly satisfying at times. Again, it's called Dr. Foster, and you can find it on Netflix. I loved it. All right. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Barry at B. Hardiman. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our other producer, Emmanuel Johnson, at Emmanuel_Speaks. Our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, is at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides the in and out music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Look, we have to give you another reminder. We want to give you another reminder. Donate to your local station. That's at donate.npr.org/happy. And we will see you all right back here next week.
When you travel to a new place, sometimes it doesn't just change where you are. It changes who you are. Next on NPR's Code Switch, a story about travel and transformation. Listen and subscribe.